the English Benedictine History Commission's conference at Ampleforth in September 2008. This lecture is Professor Nicholas Roger of the Centre for Maritime Historical Studies at Exeter University, speaking on naval chaplains. The length is 47 minutes.
What I have to present to you has nothing at all to do with monastic history, and only a bit little to do with Catholic history. So I feel myself essentially here under false pretenses. What I'm going to talk about is bits, at least, about officially appointed chaplains to the English and British Navy between Elizabethan times and the beginning of the 19th century. Obviously, therefore, these are all Anglican chaplains, so as you'll see in a moment, the question of what Anglican means is one that can debate a little. It's a subject which has been almost wholly neglected. It's profoundly uninteresting both to naval and to church historians. The literature on the subject consists of a couple of antiquarian books by retired naval chaplains and an article of Paradise and Obscurity by myself, which I propose to cannibalise for this afternoon, since I'm confident that nobody's read it. If anybody is interested in it, I've got a few offerings of it there. It only covers part of what I'm going to talk about today. As far as I know, the first officially appointed English naval chaplains, or you could call them that anyway, were attached to Fenton's unsuccessful South Atlantic voyage, 1572-3. There were two of them, John Walker and Thomas Maddox. And their appointment, it seems to me, must have been an example of how not to conduct a job interview. There seems to have been a major disparity between expectations on both sides. They thought they were joining an exploring expedition, and were shocked to discover, after they had got to sea, that everybody else saw it as an expedition of piracy. They assured the early clergymen that we could not do God better service than by spoiling the Spaniard both of life and goods. Though, this is Walker's comment, under colour of religion, all their shots at men's money. Walker was so naive or indiscreet as to carry this sentiment into his sermons, arousing very considerable opposition from his flock by preaching that armed robbery might not invariably be approved by scripture. It seems, in fact, to have been a thoroughly unhappy voyage for both of them, and in fact neither of them survived, though not because their congregation killed them off, but it was the bloody flux that did for them. Both, however, left diaries which are interesting and revealing, dry, plain, but eloquent Elizabethan prose. Here, for example, is John Walker giving a little clue as to what a chaplain actually did. And this, as I shall be saying as I go along, is actually quite difficult to find out. Rather third, being Whit Sunday, I preached of Concord, and after communion of the Holy Ghost, and the same day was seasick, and so continued unto the sixth day. Interesting that he had evidently conducted a communion service at sea. Something which was not only, I think, unusual then, but was probably practically unknown subsequently. So it's worth taking a note of it. There are chaplains appointed to quite explicitly and clearly naval operations. There were a number of chaplains appointed to the English fleet in 1588 against the Armada. There were some more attached to the 1596 Cadiz expedition. All of them officially appointed, but all of them clearly in real terms, essentially on the footing of domestic chaplains to the admirals and senior officers. One of them, Mr. Hopkins, preached at an Anglican service in Cadiz Cathedral on the 27th of June 1596, 3 days after the English seized the city. Another, Edward Doughty, who was the personal chaplain of Lord Howard of Effingham, the Lord Admiral, stole 17 works of theology from the library of the Jesuit College at Cadiz, which he subsequently presented to Hereford Cathedral Library, where they still remain as a testimony to his piety. With a nice little inscription in, I must say, less than perfect Latin as to how he had brought them back from the expedition to Cadiz. it is. All these, however, were clearly appointments for a specific, rather short-term job. The job was clearly essentially to accompany the great men. It's not clear to what extent they could or did conduct anything in the nature of a mission to the souls of the ship's company as a whole. The next big naval operation, which was the Cadiz expedition of 1623 under Lord Rutland, though the usual standing orders were issued about prayers twice a day and so on, anyone who absented themselves from prayers on Rutland's expedition without good cause was to be hit on the head with a bucket of water and fined sixpence according to ancient custom. On the other hand, there were no chaplains present, so if anybody was conducting these prayers, it certainly was not clergymen of the Church of England. There were some clergymen around. The first one I know who's serving in peacetime is in the 1630s in ship money fleets, which appear to have had some permanent chaplains. Sir John Pennington, one of the best known admirals of that day, and another one who's left a journal, has a chaplain whom he refers to as Dr. Daniel Ambrose, my chaplain. Doctor, though, this is clearly a chaplain of a high class. And there's a remarkable note in March 1638 in his diary. Having received warrant from the Lords Commissioners of the Admiralty for my coming to London, I left the command of my ship unto Dr. Daniel Ambrose, chaplain, Mr. Robert Fox, lieutenant, and Mr. Peter White, master. In that order, it appears. It's an almost unique case, as far as I know, not simply of the chaplain being treated as the senior officer of the ship, capable of taking command, but of a kind of collective leadership. I've never seen that anywhere else. Of course, the troubled times of the interregnum were times when the role of the Navy, as I must say, written in your histories, was of acute political significance, as well as, of course, acute military significance. And one in which the naval chaplains came to be at a whole set of political and religious cruxes. And it's difficult to discuss them because even to this day, the allegedly Puritan, godly, upright regime of the interregnum is still frequently held up as a kind of historical foil to the allegedly corrupt, decadent, frivolous regime of the restored Stuarts. And even respectable historians are deeply enthralled to this very ancient historical trope, much more enthralled to the image than they are to the evidence. And this is definitely true of naval chaplains, and has been ever since then. I mean, here, for example, this is a paragraph in the Gentleman's Magazine from 1746, referring to the Commonwealth times. Morality and decency were then in fashion. Chaplains did duty as well as received pay. Not one in five ever handled a card, and not one in 100 understood backgammon. Well, of course, this is in fact a sarcastic comment on the chaplains of 1746 by somebody who knew nothing whatever about what had been really going on 100 years before. But it illustrates the power of the image. The power of the image is not dead yet. The reality was rather more complicated. Perhaps just very briefly, I want to sketch, because it's surprising how little anybody has ever taught these things in school, what happened in the interregnum. The parliamentary regime, which fought and won the First and Second Civil Wars, was of course an officially Anglican one, except that as a consequence of the alliance with Scotland, necessary to win the Second Civil War, the Church of England lost its bishops and had become Presbyterian. You may think that's a big jump, but bearing in mind that the primitive theology of the Church of England was fundamentally a Calvinist one, actually it was more of a political than a theological change. They lost the bishops, who of course were there as the crown's agents, but the structure of the church seems to have remained much the same. All that changed, however, in December 1648, the military coup d'etat. Perhaps you know that the victorious Parliament engaged in a whole series of really rather imprudent measures to repress religious dissent. An Act of Parliament of 1646, for example, provided for death for Unitarians and Freethinkers and long prison sentences for Baptists and sectaries. A possibly imprudent move, since Baptists and sectaries dominated the rank and file of the new model army and contained a high proportion of the officers. And of course, they got their comeuppance when the new model army seized power. And the result of that was, of course, that power was now in the hands of those who were radicals in politics and in religion, independents in religion, members of what they would have called gathered congregations. You might almost draw the analogy with modern house churches, though in historical terms this is the ancestors of what became Congregationalism. These people had no time whatever for Presbyterians or moderates in politics. Virtually everyone who had conducted the Royalist war effort, including the Navy, was ejected forthwith and replaced by those of political and religious orthodoxy. Effectively, the entire English Navy, which is quite big, was now being run, all its senior officers and virtually all its administrators ashore, by the members of two congregations, one in Wapping and one in Shadwell. These men, virtually without exception, came from Lee-on-Sea, Borley, and two or three other small villages in East Anglia. They were all closely related, intermarried with one another. They were virtually all business partners and associates, and their businesses were entirely concerned with supplying ships, masts, timber, naval stores, and so on to the Navy. You'd hardly say that this was a most convenient arrangement for all concerned. And what made it the most convenient of all was that Sir Harry Vane, the younger, the Treasurer of the Navy, presided over all this, presented his admittedly somewhat incomplete and imperfect accounts to the Revenue Committee of Parliament, whose chairman happily chanced to be his father. And I'm digressing slightly from the chaplains, but the problem is that from 1648 to 1653, you have an extreme Republican regime, which is then in turn overthrown by another military coup d'etat led by the army's commander-in-chief, Colonel General Cromwell. And the Cromwellian protectorate is a less radical regime in political terms and in organisational governmental terms, a quasi-monarchy. So Cromwell has a lot of his former colleagues still devoted to the good old cause, seething in the army, and as he feared, also some seething in the Navy, planning to overthrow him for betraying the true Republican and independent cause. And of course you can imagine that in this context, where religion and politics are very closely identified, the role of the chaplain is exceedingly delicate. But the problem was that there was no procedure for appointing chaplains, the duties were undefined, the life was extremely hard, the pay was negligible, and the difficulty of attracting good men was fairly considerable, and of course the difficulty of defining good men was also pretty considerable. And the literature of the times is full of endless complaints about the chaplains. And there are some comments about good and satisfactory chaplains, but more often you get words like, this is the 1654 Admiralty Order, ordering that no persons were to be appointed chaplains who hadn't been approved by the Council of State. Several persons having crept into the fleet under the name of chaplains who promote opinions rather than godliness and are not agreeable in their lives and conversation to the truth of the gospel. This, I think, means ejected Anglicans and crypto-royalists. There are quite a lot of others who caused trouble. There's quite a lot who are not in orders, for a start, and some who are appointed, it appears, informally by their captains, or even by the vote of the ship's company. 1659, for example, on board the Fame, the gunner was acting as chaplain, in addition to his normal duties, to the disquiet of the captain, who said, he doth rather cause a confusion than a reformation amongst us, and may cause great disquietness in our ship. And another of the problems was that the chaplains themselves were, in any cases, deeply dissatisfied with the job. The voice was often heard, and was to be quite a refrain later on, that it was actually impossible to imagine that one could profitably preach the Christian faith to persons as reprobate as seamen. One of them, for example, said that there is such swearing at sea as if both hell were damned and all the devils in it were let loose. Were I a commander, if fair means and sweet persuasions would not prevail, I would hang them up at the main yard. This kind of thing tended to go down rather badly with the sailors, it seems, and indeed, for that matter, with, in many cases, with the officers. There are notable exceptions. There's Mr. Vincent, did Your Honour, this is, I can't say, a letter of recommendation, a genre with which many of us are familiar, did Your Honour but know the worth of that gentleman in half the measure that I did, he would be precious in your sight. To speak truth, take him to our sea by and large, take him as a scholar, take him as a godly man, an exemplary good liver. Take him as occasion be as well with a sword in his hand as the word in his mouth. If I should but endeavour to set him forth, as we say, in his proper colours, my paper would shorter be full. To say all of this letter, take him every way, I know too few such. And you'll be pleased to know that he got the job. But considering how much difficulty they had in getting chaplains who were even sober, let alone godly, this is perhaps not so surprising. He wasn't, I think, one of those who complained about the sailors. But Lord knows I took little contentment in the sea amongst that pack of rude and disorderly swearing and profane wretches that go in it. But then there are not dissimilar complaints about the chaplains. The man who was court-martialed because he'd come off his ship so drunk they were fain to hoist him on board with the yard tackles. Another who was arrested dancing naked around Carrickfergus at 2 a.m. with his wife caterwauling and waking the God-fearing inhabitants. This was the kind of thing which got the Navy a bad name and didn't exactly support the good of the cause. I leap on because I haven't much time. The later Stuarts, had themselves also some notable examples of chaplains. Notable in a slightly different way from the Republican chaplains of the 1650s. I have time only, I think, to cite the admirable character of Thomas Dockery, a man celebrated in popular song as a great fighter. The chaplain he fell to his wonted word, cried, "Now for the King and the Duke of York, he prayed like a Christian and fought like a Turk." That's in the Second Dutch War. He had the unusual, if not possibly unique, distinction of having been promoted Doctor of Divinity for gallantry in action after the St. James's Day fight. Was rewarded after the war with a good living. Went back to sea again in the Third Dutch War as chaplain to Lord Sandwich, and died still with a sword in his hand in the burning of Royal James at the Battle of Sole Bay. A notable example of a fighting clergyman. And there are some other interesting and significant naval chaplains. The celebrated Bishop Ken of Bath and Wells, some of whose hymns we still sing, was a naval chaplain in his younger days. Though I must say he was the last naval chaplain to get a bishopric in the Church of England until 1935. So there's something of a gap in quality after that. There's a splendid man who left a diary which has been printed, a very obscure man called Henry Tongue, a Warwickshire clergyman, who was called to sea to escape his creditors, but a man of the most attractive character, who's left a very interesting and revealing diary, giving us lots of information about his life at sea, and incidentally, something about what he himself actually did. Tongue preached, and he preached at sea, which seems already to have been relatively unusual. He reports once having the sermon interrupted by a very great school of porpoises on both sides of our ship, many of them jumping their whole length out of the water, causing much laughter. And we know that there was a proportion of chaplains, though not a hugely large proportion, in the fleets of this period. The fleet which assembled in 1688 to resist the Dutch invasion had 8 chaplains out of 38 warships. And that seems to be about the highest figure you would expect. They're invariably the biggest ships. The chaplains are, again, very frequently essentially on the footing of domestic chaplains to the great men, to the captains and the admirals. It's also at this period, however, Pepys, you won't be surprised, was involved, that you get the first regulations for the appointment of chaplains and the first system of examination by an examining bishop, the Bishop of London, responsible for examining the chaplains. You also get, and this is rather interesting, in the aftermath of the Popish plot and the exclusion crisis of 1678, this is of course the period in which the Test Acts are first introduced by all naval officers, amongst others, have to swear an oath abhorring transubstantiation and produce a certificate that they had received the sacrament according to the rites of the Church of England in the previous 12 months. This was an embarrassment almost from the beginning. A survey in 1679 of all the officers of the Navy revealed that hardly any of them were in the habit of taking communion at all, and that included the chaplains. Few of whom, it appeared, had even attended a communion service within the previous 12 months, let alone actually conducted one. And that's a communion service anywhere at all, still less, clearly, were they customary afloat. There's also a question which I've never seen addressed, but in the long term, of course, it's worth pointing out that this was the Royal Navy of King Charles II of England and Scotland, and subsequently of King James VII and II. Many of the officers were Scots, and no provision was made for anybody to take the sacrament according to the rites of the Church of Scotland, if indeed they could have obtained it. But as a matter of practice, I've never found any Scots officer making any difficulty about taking the oath that he had received the sacrament of the Church of England. I presume they were not perjuring themselves, and so I assume they simply didn't regard the theological distinctions, I mean the differences of theology on this matter, as being of any importance, or perhaps they weren't aware that those differences existed. What is already the case, however, is clearly that taking the sacrament was essentially regarded as a test of political loyalty, that is an expression of faith or belief. It seems to be exceedingly unusual, as far as I can discover, for anybody in the Navy at all to take the sacrament, and virtually unknown for them to do so or to have any opportunity of doing so on board one of HM's ships. I jump on again quite rapidly. It seems to me that the 1688-1689 so-called revolution does have some modest effects in reviving some of the spirit of seriousness, if you like, which at its best had characterized maybe 1650. The Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge, which was founded in 1699, was intensely interested in the Navy and devoted a good deal of its efforts and funds to distributing, printing and distributing prayer books and so on to sailors. They distributed the Seaman's Monitor, cautions against swearing, always a good thing for the Navy, cautions against drunkenness, still more to the point, persuasions to the observance of the Lord's Day, rather less useful aboard ship where there wasn't many opportunities to do so, and catechisms. And many of the admirals of this generation backed the godly work and encouraged it. And there are quite a number of captains who are known to have been encouraging it. Rooke, very unusually, spoke at least of encouraging chaplains to administer the sacrament. And this incidentally implies that the chaplains were in orders. Not all chaplains were in priests' orders. Quite a lot of them seem to be only deacons. But here is somebody who says, "I doubt not but that in a little time the pious example that Sir George gives in having prayers twice a day on board the Queen will be imitated throughout the whole fleet." Well, I'm not sure if it was, but it's quite interesting to observe that at least at that period an admiral was trying. On the other hand, at precisely the same date, we have a record of a chaplain's trials with a drunken first lieutenant who on the quarterdeck asserted, "God damn the warrant officers," well, of course the chaplain was one of them, "he hoped to see them as little as dirt under his feet, that they were little animals and he would never be servants to any of them." It is perhaps just permissible to suspect that this chaplain may have lacked a certain degree of tact. He subsequently finished his career by attempting to read the royal proclamation against drunkenness to his drunken captain on the quarterdeck, which some may feel was foolhardy. Here's a journal of Thomas Pocock, chaplain of another flagship in 1704, a characteristic figure at the time. He was married to the chaplain's sister, to the admiral's sister-in-law. He came, of course, from the most excellently connected family. His own son, in fact, was a future admiral. And he preaches on the admiral's quarterdeck on Sundays. He reads prayers on Sunday evenings. He catechizes the volunteers, that is to say, what we might call the naval cadets, at the officer's boys and distributed 500 pious books amongst the ship's company. I gave six young gentlemen sixpence apiece for learning the first six psalms. This afternoon I played at tables with the captain. And then later on, the captain and I received the sacrament at Portsmouth. No service this afternoon because we took in provisions. A little later on, prayers and sermon this morning, catechism in the afternoon. This afternoon I visited the Chaplain General, Mr. Barry, who entertained me with much civility. This, I think, gives us something like a high point of chaplain's activities in the early 18th century. Clearly he moves almost exclusively in the company of gentlemen. He does consider himself as having a mission to the ship's company at large, but it consists in distributing books and in preaching sermon now and again. The people he actually has any personal dealings with are gentlemen like himself, or in this case, the young gentlemen as well. Though this, to my knowledge, is the last mention for more than 100 years of a chaplain taking an interest in instructing youth of any class whatever, and I think the last mention of the distribution of any literature to the lower deck until the late 1790s. It's clear, in fact, that we are moving quite rapidly into the 18th century, in an age when printed sermons of all sorts find a very rapid, ready sale. The last printed sermon issued by a chaplain in the Navy that I can find is in 1706, the last one for almost 80 years. Much more characteristic in the 18th century is the chaplain who, if appointed at all, is a more or less permanent absentee from his job. And if you get chaplains at all who can be ascertained to be present on board ship, even occasionally, they seem generally to have been fairly unhappy. The first edition of the regulations and instructions relating to His Majesty's service at sea in 1731 requires that divine service should be conducted regularly, but fails to mention chaplains at all, and nor did any subsequent edition until the major revision of 1806. The captain had to see that divine service be performed twice a day on board according to the liturgy of the Church of England, and a sermon preached on Sundays, unless bad weather or an extraordinary accident prevented, but there was no suggestion that a clergyman would be required to do it. It has to be said that bad weather or other extraordinary accidents appear to have been very prevalent indeed in the 18th century. Though it's difficult to prove a negative, there are virtually no references to any kind of service being held on shipboard between the end of Queen Anne's War in 1713 and the American War 65 years later. Just a handful, I know, but very few indeed. In 1734, Admiral Sir John Norris wrote to his first captain expressing the hope that the minister is aboard and that there may be prayers twice a day for the people who grow dissolute for want of strict discipline. The context is worth noting. The following year, he ordered the minister preach every Sunday against swearing and debauchery. This seems to have been about the height of religious devotion that was available and pretty rare. Charles Middleton and his nephew James Gambier in the American War, who are prominent early figures in the evangelical revival which hit the Navy early and hard, were accused quite widely of being Methodists and sectaries for attempting to conduct prayers on board ship on Sundays. You do find a few others. In 1755, on board Admiral Boscawen's flagship, the Torbay, then in the Atlantic, there was a Sunday service, but it was held in the wardroom. It's clear the ship's company was not present or expected to take any interest. And, as I say, the absence of published sermons is a striking witness to this. When you do begin to encounter naval church services in the 1770s, they're almost all on board flagships, almost always in port, and described in terms which suggest that public worship and worship was a novelty arousing astonishment. You get a handful of printed sermons at this period, but they're almost invariably printed at their author's expense, which is rather a significant thing in an age when you could normally sell sermons very easily. 1775, the chaplain of Sir Challoner Ogle's flagship, records that the duty of a clergyman was very seldom required of me while I was chaplain for the Resolution. One day, however, the Admiral did ask him to read prayers, and he ventured to suggest that he would be happy to do it more often, to which Sir Challoner replied in a tone which seems to suggest something less than devout enthusiasm. At all events, I think it is right that these things should be done sometimes, so long as Christianity is on foot. But here I think we hear the authentic, anti-clerical, rather detached voice of the nobility of the age. It's a suspect recollection, I have to say, from a deeply sententious and dishonest memoir. But you can get from more reliable sources a similar flavour. 3 years later, for example, Benjamin Millingchamp joins Sir Edward Hughes' flagship as chaplain. And he notes the captain, last Saturday, asked me if it was agreeable to read prayers and give him a sermon the following day. Said it was a very unusual thing in harbour, but hoped I had no objection. And it was an even more unusual thing at sea, though I know just a handful of references to happening. The main reason why chaplains are to be found mainly only in flagships, or at least in very big ships, was financial. A chaplain received the pay of an ordinary seaman. This is not terribly an attractive financial incentive. 17 and sixpence a lunar month net of fixed deductions. But he also received 4 pence a man a month from every member of the ship's company, which in a big ship would amount to about £150 a year, which is well up in the salary of excellent curacy or a quite reasonable rural living. But it did depend on having a big ship's company to subscribe their unwilling fourpences to keep you going. Even so, there weren't two obvious problems in the way of any naval chaplain, if there were any such, who hoped to carry on the cure of souls, namely the officers and the ratings. The officers are affected by the climate of difference and anti-clericalism, which I referred to before. The days were long past when a man might be dismissed the service for blasphemy. Which happened once in 1676, but admittedly in rather peculiar circumstances, it was essentially a cover for something else. What you get at this period, mid to late 18th century, are essentially people emphasising the worldly conveniences of the Church of England rather than its religious operation. I don't want to fall into the old caricatures that you could read a lot of 40 years ago about the torpor of the 18th century Church of England, but nevertheless, it was clearly marked by its Erastian situation. This is the period when Bishop Warburton, thinking about a question of the Methodist, says the extraordinary operation of the Holy Ghost was no longer necessary now that the profession of the Christian faith is attended with all ease and honour. This is the period when George Grenville divided bishoprics into two categories, bishops of business for men of abilities and learning, and bishops of ease for men of family and fashion. Men of godliness and prayer didn't figure in his list at all. And in this context, clergyman's first recourse was respectability rather than spirituality, and his immediate trial was likely to be the irreligious tone of wardroom life, if indeed he was admitted to the wardroom, since chaplains were only warrant officers and had no automatic right to be admitted amongst officers and gentlemen. In 1758, one chaplain wrote an ironic poem lamenting his failure to attain that ultimate symbol of the status of a gentleman, access to the officers' quarter gallery, that is to say, the officers' latrine. And there are complaints about the tone of wardroom life. Nothing could be more shocking and mortifying to me, or to any mind which possessed a particle of moral delicacy or intellectual improvement, than the manners and conversation of the sea officers. I speak of what they were in general almost half a century ago, this would make it 1756. I hope they are better now. In 1812, we get a very similar reflection. With a gentleman's education, but without a sufficient income, my new undertaking had rather the air of desperation than of enterprise. And long accustomed to the society of the polite, the learned, and the effeminate, I was now to dwell with those to whom not any of these epithets could possibly be applied. That's the Reverend Edward Mangin, a prebendary of Killaloe in Ireland, who had never visited his prebend, or indeed even in Ireland, but had been living in Bath for the previous 8 years, when it appears he'd got into financial difficulties which forced him to go to sea. Bagehot was horrified by the possibility, the idea even, that somebody might expect him to make some religious contact with the ship's company, a thing which he regarded as completely impossible, to introduce sailors to rational religion. To meet them unreproved and vicious was possible. I dare say it was equally possible to have transformed them all into Methodists or madmen and hypocrites of some other kind. But to convert a Batmore's crew into Christians would be a task to which the courage of Loyola, the philanthropy of Howard, and the eloquence of St. Paul United would prove inadequate. So, of course, he didn't try. The problem was a widespread one. What on earth was a chaplain to do? In the best possible circumstances, under a deeply sympathetic captain, there might possibly be an opportunity to conduct prayers at infrequent intervals and possibly even to preach a sermon when in port now and again. That was about it, really. It didn't seem to amount to very much of a job description. Here we have Bagehot again. I could neither drink nor play at cards with such as indulged these pastimes. To go among the crew and discourse to them of religion and morality, I had already shown to be not very practicable. I accordingly felt myself most awkwardly situated and fancied I was somewhat like a pet bear on board. I was fed, coaxed, and stared at, if in my dead and forgotten, if large in everybody's way, of no manner of use, at best endured. Another clergyman reports that clergyman in a man of war, if he would assert the dignity of his character, is considered as a nuisance, as a damp to that gaiety and licentiousness which reigns without control among the sons of the waves. Everything he sees and hears is an insult to his office. Such swearing, such obscenity, such contempt for everything serious and religious continually satiates you. Believe me, I'm quite tired of a life so infernal. A difficult problem. What tends to have happened is that those without the nerve or talent like Mangin quitted the service very quickly, and more robust and experienced men found something useful to do, something that is to say other than being a chaplain. There are a number of different things you find them doing, but by far the most common, since they were nearly all operating in the near vicinity of admirals, was essentially to adopt some kind of a function of being a staff officer. Often they seem to have fallen into a function which we might regard as that of an intelligence officer. Frequently also, they were called upon to write the official account of the expedition, all the more necessary in those cases when the fortunes of war left the chief with a reputation to urgently in need of repair. Say, for example, Cooper Williams, lately John Jarvis's chaplain, published an account of the campaign in the West Indies in 1794, in endeavour to repair the very severe damage which his chief and military colleagues, Charles Grey, had done themselves by their rapacious, dishonest handling of booty and prize money. On a less sophisticated level, Lawrence Halloran, a chaplain to Lord North Esk's flagship at Battle of Trafalgar, an Irishman who was subsequently discovered to be an imposter, falsely claiming to be in orders and was eventually transported to Australia, made himself useful on board with his powerful voice repeating the captain's orders through a speaking trumpet. One thing, though, is common. Basically, these people are there not as chaplains to the ship, but as chaplains to the great man. Perhaps you know the well-known Hogarth portrait of Captain Lord George Graham, seated in his cabin in 1746, surrounded by his domestics. His domestics are his chaplain, the captain's cook, his clerk, his black servant, his spaniel, and his poodle. And that's precisely where the average naval chaplain needs to be located. 1793 Commons debate on a proposal that East Indiamen should carry chaplains. One director of the company whispered to his neighbour, "I think a chaplain no bad thing. I shan't oppose him. He may always serve to make the grog, and always be ready for a fourth and a whist." I think I wouldn't go so far as to say that was the only thing the chaplains had to do, but it does sort of indicate the kind of circumstances. A very well-known example is the celebrated Alexander Scott, Admiral's secretary in turn to Sir Hyde Parker and subsequently Sir Nelson. Scott accompanied his chief, Sir Hyde Parker, to the Baltic in 1801, establishing, it's been suggested, something of a record in long-distance pluralism since he was at the time incumbent of St John's, Jamaica. This convivial messmate, linguist, diplomatist, and man of business, went to sea with a harpsichord and a library of 650 volumes, who learnt Danish in 24 hours to negotiate the aftermath of the Battle of Copenhagen, but complained that Russian was considerably more difficult and took him nearly a week to master, represents, in some respects, I think, one of the best of the 18th century English naval chaplains. A good man with a good job to do, though it had almost nothing, except accidentally, to do with the fact that he was a clergyman. A good many of them, though, were essentially there for extraneous reasons. They'd gone to sea to escape debt, one had gone to sea grief, the suicide of his wife, another had gone to sea to escape the claws of the Tigris, who was very much alive. And there are a whole variety of accidental reasons why they get there. Of course, in these circumstances, it was very frequently the case that the clergymen had their warrants and enjoyed their pay, but did not trouble to appear on board. This seems to have been regarded as absolutely normal for most of the 18th century, until the arrival of a man not usually known as a defender of the church, as First Lord of the Admiralty, namely Lord Sandwich. Sandwich causes consternation, this is mainly in the 1770s, by insisting that chaplains should be present on board the ships to which they belonged. I fear the attending in London upon a literary business and the duty of a sea chaplain are incompatible, especially as he can receive no pay but in consequence of his attending musters regularly on board ship. If a fortnight's leave of absence would enable Mr. Stockdale to finish his pamphlet, I could strain a point to make it easy to him, but I could not go any further without subjecting you who recommended him, and myself who appointed him, to a great deal of well-founded abuse. Stockdale was appalled. Why, you were so good as to apply for me for this chaplaincy. Neither you nor I thought that in consequence of obtaining it, I should be obliged to be near the ship or on board. In 3 years, drawing pay as chaplain of the guardship Resolution, he had never once gone afloat. And he resigned rather than shift from his comfortable lodgings opposite Brothel and Portsmouth Point when the ship was mobilised. 10 years later, when Sandwich had been replaced at the Admiralty by Lord Howe, Stockdale spent an entire commission as chaplain to the flagship of the Mediterranean fleet, living ashore at Gibraltar, and preaching occasionally when his ship touched port. I think, nevertheless, that Sandwich is in some respects a forerunner. And the other thing which is clearly about to change is the arrival of these blue lights, as they were called, the early naval evangelicals. The blue lights were a kind of fireworks used for night signalling in the Navy. The early evangelicals' nickname was the blue lights. But I must say, I differ somewhat from Richard Blake, the only person who studied them, who is, he's a good scholar, but he writes from rather within a confessional identity, and he's very much prepared to take them at face value as being godly men out to reform the Navy. I think they were godly men, but I'm afraid I think that discipline was in fact what their primary concern, more than communicating vital religion. In the opinion, for example, of Rear Admiral Kempenfelt, who's one of the earliest of them, religion is particularly necessary in the common people to preserve morals. In other words, I think we're talking about public religion as an aid to dutiful behaviour, not private conversion as a means to win the souls for God. Kempfert was a man of real piety himself, and I don't think he thought that it was possible to communicate that to common seamen. And after the French Revolution, the idea that religion was necessary to cement political order was all the more obvious. Here, for example, is Captain John Duckworth in 1794. There never was an era when the circulating of religion and morality appeared more evidently necessary, especially among the lower orders of people, than at present. Divine service is now becoming much more common, and it's often associated with people like Sir John Jarvis, future Lord St. Vincent, who cared a good deal more for discipline than vital religion. In 1797, he managed to get rid of his second-in-command, Sir Charles Thompson, who had complained that the Admiral had profaned the Sabbath by hanging men for mutiny during morning prayers. This, I think, is a fair estimate of what Jarvis's view of church service ought to be. There are certainly a lot of really Magellan's pushing things. This is the period of the foundation of that iconic organisation which still exists, the Naval and Military Bible Society, founded by officers, with the intention of evangelising their men. And it's also the period when the first printed sermons by naval chaplains begin to reappear in the booksellers' lists. In 1798, for example, James Stanier Clark, future biographer of Nelson, published a volume of naval sermons preached on board His Majesty's ship, the Impetua, in the Western Squadron, during its services off Brest, to which is added a thanksgiving sermon for naval victories preached at Park Street Chapel, Grosvenor Square. And this is quite a neat witness to the rising status of the naval chaplain and his duties, for I can't think of two less likely places to find a naval chaplain in the 1740s or 50s or 60s than preaching on board a ship at sea in wartime, or preaching to the congregation of a fashionable West End chapel. During the 19th century, a climate of moral and religious opinion was to develop, which took the chaplain seriously, at least as an aid to good order of naval discipline, and possibly even as an instrument of personal conversion. But the problem for the 18th century naval chaplain was that in default of any kind of sacramental theology, they had essentially nothing to do. If you look at what French naval chaplains were doing at this period, you find they were, at least on paper, very highly trained. Regulations required them to say mass daily. Their duties as laid out in the regulations would have occupied them about 6 or 8 hours a day. They had to catechize all the boys in the ship. They had to administer the sacraments naturally. They had to say mass daily, though it would have been a dry mass at sea normally. They also were pretty thoroughly trained. Amongst other things, all French naval chaplains trained at the seminary at Brest had to speak Breton, and all those trained in the seminary in Toulon had to speak the Languedoc, which would have separated them from almost all other French officers, many of whom couldn't communicate with their men. But the English chaplains had essentially no job to do. And it's inevitable that a profession with poor pay, little work, and uncertain prospects would have difficulty attracting the best men. Really, it's only with the development after 1812 of the chaplain schoolmaster that the Navy finds a well-paying, useful berth for clergymen. And even then, it seems to me that it has more to do with the decencies of public worship and the study of mathematics rather than winning souls for God.